you had a program you want to run, you had to go in and run the computer yourself, you know, and compile your program into machine language and then execute it and see if it ran or not. And so you had to sign up for time.
Those are kind of like a card system?
They used punch cards. Okay. Sure did. There was, we didn't have disk, you know, so you, when you, there was a stack of cards, about 2000 cards, which what we call the compiler, which translated from Fortran into the machine code that the machine could actually run. So you had to run and load this compiler in before you even started, ran your program in to be translated into machine code.
Oh my gosh.
So you learned a lot about how to operate the computer as a student.
Right.
And of course, people with microcomputers nowadays that are on the desk, they operate the computer. So that's what I say. In some sense, when I started, it was closer to what we're doing today than it was at, say, when I came to Clemson. There was, you know, it was a big computer and they had, you know, a whole staff of people running it. Well, they still do that, the mainframe down in the research park. Had a staff of people that operated it. And you turned in a deck of cards, you know, and said, please run my program. And the next day you'd come back and you'd get your deck of cards back and a printout of what happened with your program. And maybe it ran, maybe it didn't. And you didn't run, you'd go punch a few more cards, you know, different instructions in your Fortran program and try it again. So it was very, you know, you got one run a day, maybe two if you were lucky.
Yeah.
So it took a lot of time and it's just a different way of doing things than what we do, much, much different. So the technology's changed, the software's changed, the architecture of applications has changed. There's a lot of stuff you can get today that's already canned, if you will. Mm-hmm. Routines that do what you don't have to write. You know, you just call them and they do whatever you want them to do. And, you know, I know that one of the things I did as an undergraduate was to calculate pi. Mm-hmm. In 3.1415, you know, right. Anyway, calculate to 1,000 decimal digits. Now, not that we needed that, but that was an exercise.
Right.
And that's hard to do. I would venture to guess that hardly any of the undergraduates or even the graduate students at Clemson today could do that. and the reason is because the hardware was different today than it than it was back then. You don't get that kind of precision. You can kind of invent it if you do learn to do your own arithmetic, but people don't do their own arithmetic. They have a machine add two numbers together. You don't have to figure out how to add and divide. You know, like we had to back in those days.
Right.
So anyway, that's probably getting off the subject some. But
no, you're fine.
But software, hardware, methods, you know, all of that has changed so much from when I started to where we are today. I have my own company now. You can probably see it here.
Yeah.
I was foolish enough when I retired to start my own company. And so we're doing a lot of work in logistics, doing a lot of work in really supply chain management, order fulfillment and distribution centers. My elevator pitch when someone says, what do? I say, well, you know, you push the button when you're ordering something from Amazon, you push the enter button on your PC or click on the button with your mouse, and 2 days later it shows up at your door. A lot of stuff that happens in between. some of our customers, for example, are picking 2.5 million orders in a 5-day period.
Oh my word.
How do you do that? You can't go out with a box and put stuff in the box, you know, 2.5 million in a 5-day period. How many people does it take? So you have to invent clever ways of doing it, which are a lot more efficient than what normally comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And so those are real challenges.
Can you give me an example of how that works?
Well, are you familiar with something called IPSI?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, IPSI, we're doing all the work for fulfilling the orders for IPSI.
Oh, I get IPSI every month.
That's right. IPSI, for whoever's listening to this recording, is a company that's subscription-based cosmetics.
Right.
So every month you get what they call a glam bag, which has, I think, 8 or 10 different samples. And then there's some things, if you get points, I don't know, they can put some extras in there that you can choose and what all. You know, you fill out a profile, you know, your gender, your age, your race, your complexion, all of that stuff you fill out in advance. They have some artificial intelligence, which kind of matches you to the samples that they're going to send you, hopefully. And so, in any event, we're picking 2.5 million orders for IPSI in a 5-day period once a month.
Wow.
That's a challenge.
I bet. Yeah.
We're picking for over $18,000 general stores with our technology that we developed.
Oh, wow.
And these are things I was doing in a research mode at the university, in the lab. I've taken some of the ideas that we had and have actually developed them into computer software and gone out and put them out into industry now. So it's doing a lot of clever, in fact, we're using a lot of artificial intelligence. Okay. And a lot of the stuff that we're doing here with my company. So that's probably getting off the subject a little
no,
bit.
No, it's not. I was going to ask you about your current works and your work since leaving Clemson. Yeah. So
well, Dr. Ed Page, who was also a faculty member at Clemson, he was actually started out as a computer engineer in computer engineering and moved to computer science after several years and joined the computer science faculty. And I actually retired before Ed did in 2000. And Ed retired, I don't know, 4 or 5 years later. And we formed a company, and we went ahead and developed computer hardware and software for order fulfillment. In fact, in 2019, we were selected by the Council on Computer Supply Chain Management Professionals. That's the largest professional organization in supply chain. We were selected as the most innovative company in the United States.
Oh my!
For a lot of the stuff that Ed and I had done.
That's incredible.
So, and we're actually in the same competition this year, and we're one of the four finalists. I don't know if we'll be selected as the winner, but we'd like to. So anyway, we're doing a lot of interesting things with the hardware that we develop, which has small computers on circuit boards that we develop. In fact, two of them, and the computers talk to one another and that type thing. We're doing a lot of work in genetic algorithms. We're using the principles of biology now to solve very, very hard problems.
Like what?
Well, one example of a problem that we'd solved, you've received stuff in the mail from Amazon and other places where there's a big box and a little something in it with a lot of air and, and dunnage, you know, filler and stuff in that big box. Well, all the small parcel carriers, you know, UPS, FedEx, DHL, all of them change their charging methods so that they are more dependent on the dimensions of the box you're shipping versus the weight of the box. They used to charge only on weight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if everybody ships the boxes twice as large as it really needs to be, they have to drive two trucks, fly two airplanes, have two drivers. It's costing them a lot of money.
Right.
So they finally figured that out and said, wait a minute, we're going to start charging on dimensions so people won't be shipping as much air. Well, question is then, given the dimensions of all the items that I want to order from Amazon or whoever the company might be, if I know the length, width, height, weight of each item that I'm going to order, how do you figure out which box of maybe 40 or 50 boxes is best suited to ship this stuff with minimal air? Well, that's a hard problem. And if there's before you even get to that, though, there's another problem that we use genetic algorithms for, and that is to say, what 30, 40, 50, 60 boxes should I carry in my inventory so that I will be shipping less air? And so what we do is we look at the historical orders that a company has been shipping in, say, the last 6 months, which could be thousands of orders.
Right.
And we say, okay, what boxes should have you had to ship to pack what those orders required? What boxes should have you had? And we know which boxes in some cases. Snap-on Tools is a customer of ours. They knew what boxes they had used. They had 13 different box sizes. So what we have to do then is to figure out how a human would actually pack these items, because, you know, if you look at an item, this one, my sunglasses, it could be packed like this, like this, like this. You know, there's a lot of different ways they can be rotated and oriented, you know, in a box. Then the second item has to be put in there relative to the first. And then if you got the second one won't fit, maybe you put the wrong orientation on the first one. So anyway, a human doing that, you know, can do it. How do you tell a machine to do that, though? How do you figure out what a human would be doing, you know? And so artificial intelligence is kind of an ill-defined term, but the way I kind of like to define it is to say that you want a computer that will do the same thing that an intelligent person would do, but do it better and hopefully faster. And so with e-commerce, you're ordering, what, 3 to 5 things at most? So a human can figure out how to orient them pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you tell the machine to do that? Or how do you tell the machine how to do it if there's 500 items you want to pack and it takes 10 boxes? What set of boxes should you have? And things like trash cans, where one could be nested inside the other, you know, tapered trash cans.
Mm-hmm.
A human would actually do that. The computer has to be able to figure out that was what a human would do. And when it virtually packs the box to figure out which one of the boxes it should be selecting, it has to do as a human would do. It has to understand that they could be nested. It has to understand that maybe the center of a trash can is hollow and other things could go in there. It has to understand that some things must go this side up. It has to understand that fragile things can't go on the bottom where heavier things could crush them. It has to understand that, you know, if you're packing frozen items, you can't use any box. You have to use insulated boxes. There's a lot of things that really that you have to. You have to. The computer has to be able to figure out, based upon the algorithms that we tell it, and again, using artificial intelligence algorithms, to be able to figure out how a human would do it, and then pick the right box. And the real test, though, is you have to do it in less than a second. And so Snap-on Tools is actually doing it. They're one of our first customers that implemented this.
Mm-hmm.
They're saving $1 million a year on UPS charges.
Wow.
They're saving 30% on their packing labor because the people that were using the eyeball method of selecting a box were getting it wrong a high percentage of the time.
Yeah.
And then their dunnage and the corrugated material. I mean, it's a lot using smaller, better boxes so you don't chopping down as many trees and destroying as much animal habitat. And, you know, the carbon footprint of UPS and FedEx is lower now because they're not driving as many trucks.
That's incredible. They get more on a
truck. So there's lots of side benefits in addition to simply, you know,
profit.
using smaller boxes.
Yeah. So is that why it's called genetic algorithms?
Well, because it's... yeah, well, we're using genetic algorithms, which I didn't tell you about. But, I could probably spend a few hours on that. I'll just give you a real high-level understanding. You know, in biology, we have genes that are linked together into chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
And people, animals, all have chromosomes. And so we take two animals that have particularly good characteristics, whether it be animals that have nice, you know, smooth fur, whether they're smart animals, whatever the, you know, we look at it in terms of what those genes can represent. We take animals and we oftentimes breed them together. You think of horse racing.
Right.
So we breed, you know, two animals that are really winners, you know, on the track. We breed them together and hopefully the offspring gets some of the genes from one, some of the genes from another, and he's even better than either of the parents.
Right.
That's what the hope is. We do the same thing with computers. So I would have a solution. Let's say I have 40 boxes that I'm looking at and say, well, I think maybe these 40 boxes are really good boxes that we ought to be selecting from when packing things. Well, there's another 40. Maybe these are good 40 too. A third 40. So maybe I have 100 sets of these 40. Well, each one of those sets of 40 is roughly analogous to a chromosome.
Okay.
And the boxes, the 40 that's in that set, are analogous to genes. And so I take, what I do is we score each one of these chromosomes as to how good they are by saying, let's take 100,000 orders and run it through this first set of 40, and again, understanding we have an algorithm which understands which one to select of the 40 for every one of the orders. Collectively, those 100,000 orders, how much wasted space do we have? How much air? Okay, that's the score. We call it a fitness function. That's the score of the first chromosome, the first set of 40 boxes. Then the second set of 40 boxes, we'd say the same set of 100,000 orders, we run it through that second set of 40 boxes, that second chromosome. It has a score. And the third and the fourth and the fifth, maybe 100 or 1,000 of them, whatever you can afford to do. Then what you do is you rank them. This one over here was the very best one because it has the least amount of wasted space.
Okay.
Here's the second best one, the third best one, the fourth one, so we rank them. From 1 to 100, let's say, different chromosomes, different sets of 40. Then what we do is we select two of the chromosomes, two of the sets of 40 at random, and we crossbreed them. Call a crossover function. We take some of the genes, some of the boxes from one and some of the boxes from another to produce yet another set of 40. And we score that one based upon how much waste space it has for those 100,000 orders. And then we put it into the list of 100 where it belongs according to the score. Maybe the one at the bottom gets bumped off because it wasn't as good as that one was. And so we do that millions of times. So we crossbreed these solutions just like you would crossbreed animals. And you get better and better and better and better solutions. And occasionally we introduce a mutation into it by grabbing a box that never was used in any of them, perhaps, and introducing it as a gene into one of the chromosomes. And we continue this process. So the one at the top is always the best. So if you run it for 8 or 10 or 12 hours or more, you know, the one at the top is the best.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking with the Dean of Engineering yesterday here at Clemson. And there's a fertile area of research. And a lot of the things that we're talking about are industrial engineering problems. And so we have a gentleman who's working with us from the Ukraine that we hired into my company. He's escaped Ukraine when Russia started sending missiles into his apartment building with his family. He has two daughters and a wife. One of the daughters is disabled, and so he was able to come to the States. Anyway, he's got a doctorate degree. And so I was talking to the dean of engineering of perhaps being able to take advantage of some of his talents and some of his research capabilities, you know, with some of the faculty and students at, you know, in industrial engineering to do research. And so these types of things are good for Clemson. They're good for my company. They're good for the country. They're good for our customers. So we're trying to put together a lot of things which make a lot of sense and, you know, for everyone.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I'm sorry. I know I was just staring at you while you explained it, but I
may have not explained it very well, but
I think I understand.
You've got just a little bit of a gist of how it relates to biology. We call it biologically inspired algorithms is the term that we use. Or some people, we call it evolutionary algorithms because it kind of, you know, continues to get better and better and better over time.
No, the idea makes sense. On a broad level.
Yeah. There's a lot more to it than what I just told you about,
by the way.
But a lot of open research problems still there. That's why we're interested in talking with industrial engineering folks.
Yeah. So you also mentioned AI and that you don't necessarily think that's the best term.
Well, been a lot of publicity in recent times with AI.
Oh, it's
terrible. It's going to take over, you know, the world. And, this, you know, watch out. It's coming to take over your job. Well, I think there's a lot more fear than there needs to be. Yeah, we do have to kind of look at what we're doing and make sure we don't do something illegal or immoral than the way I look at it. But if I can make a person more productive, you know, then that's great.
Mm-hmm.
If I can make a product cost less, then you can afford to buy it.
Right.
And so, you know, those are the good things that I look at of coming out of AI. You look at some of the things with self-driving cars, which do use some forms of artificial intelligence. You know, if you like same-day delivery, maybe you just need to put that item that comes to your house in a self-driving car to drive it over there. Because otherwise, if you put a person in there to drive that car, you might not be able to afford it.
Right.
It's going to cost more money. On the other hand, if you look at the extreme, if everybody lost their job, who's going to buy anything? So it can't happen. You know, the people have to have money to buy things.
Right.
And so somebody's going to have to produce it. So there's a limiting factor as to how far we can reduce, you know, employment in this country. Right now, we need people. And so when I go out to sell our products, I say, look, two things you got to look at. You want to reduce your headcount in your company, or you want to get more out of the door with the same people? And most everybody says, I want to get more out of the door with the same people because I don't have enough people. And so so that's where we are today, and that's where we're looking at making people more efficient with AI rather than getting rid of people with AI.
Right, so a helper, not a replacer.
Exactly. If I can make a person more productive by having them walk you know, smaller distances in a warehouse, they can pick more stuff. That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it probably makes their job easier and not as strenuous as well.
Exactly. And there's a lot of things called AMRs, autonomous mobile robots, that people are doing a lot of work in my field in.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is to not have a person push a cart, you know, a half mile all the way over from the picking area to the shipping area. Why don't you have an AMR do that? Then the person could be over there picking more and become more efficient in picking. Because if he has to push a cart and it takes him 10 minutes, that's 10 minutes he's not picking. Have some other technology to do that.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So I know that you've developed some patents. I assume that's through your company.
Yes.
So.
Well, I developed two patents when I was at the university in Clemson Apparel Research, which was I didn't probably talk about that as much as I should have, but Chris Jarvis Triscoll and I started it. Continued on, funded by the Department of Defense. I think 1 year we had, what, $12 or $15 million a year coming in. And so maybe that was a multiple year, but in any event, a good bit of money. One of the things I did was to develop, and we got two patents on it at the university, develop the technology, both hardware and software, for talking to your sewing machine and have it sew rather than having to use your legs.
Oh, wow.
And so it's particularly good for handicapped people
that's
that
what
can't
I was
use
ask
their
about.
Legs. They can talk to their sewing machine now. and tell it what to do.
That's
so
wild.
We had speech recognition, and the speech recognition did the equivalent of what would have been done had you been using the foot pedal on your sewing machine. And we actually hired a disabled, kind of, we checked every box except one. He was a black disabled Vietnam veteran who had lost his legs.
Wow.
And so he was not Hispanic. That was the only box we didn't check. But he was a great guy. And so we hired him. And actually, Voc Rehab worked with us on that. And they funded a portion of his pay. But because he was in the state system, his pay was defined according to the grades and those type of things in the state system.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a sewing machine operator one or something like that. And so his disability pay he was getting exceeded the pay we could offer him.
Mm-hmm.
So after several months, he was great. He's doing a great job. Everybody loved him. He was crazy about the job. He came in and said, I'm going to have to quit. So why is that? He says, well, I'm making more with my disability than I am with this job. And he says, and I need the money. And so he said, can I work here for free? And just to use my disability, get my disability? Nope, that's against the rules. Can't do that. It's against the law. So we lost him.
Wow.
But those are the kind of things that you hate to see happen. But sometimes the bureaucracy gets ahead of common sense.
Yeah.
Gets in the way of common sense. Anyway, so yeah, but I developed two patents doing with speech technology. And we developed products, and they worked, and we tested them. And but again, the university back in those days, I don't know about now, but was not as good in terms of taking patents and research at the university and going out and putting them into practice in industry.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons that I took early retirement, to be able to do that myself in my own company without having to worry about, you know, here's rule number 13 that says you got to do this, that, and the other. You can kind of use common sense a lot more often than you can with state government. I'm not too critical of state government because there's a reason we have those rules. But sometimes you make up rules which shouldn't apply to every situation. But when you make them up, they're there and you can't really violate them.
So since you were at the university and doing university research when you developed that, does mm-hmm. the university own the patent?
Well, no. The work I did at the university was completely different from the work that I do at my company now.
Mm-hmm.
I never did anything in distribution, for example, at the university, which is really what I'm in now. The only thing I did at the university, particularly Clemson Apparel Research, was apparel manufacturing, which we don't do.
Right.
So, yeah, there was no overlap at all. But clearly, I took some of the ideas that I used to use in the classroom and in the research lab both. I took the ideas, not the technology, though.
Right.
I mean, ideas are ideas. You really can't, you know, take that out of a person's head and patent the ideas. And that happened. Our first patents we got were about 6 years after I left the university.
Okay.
The first patent was issued in 2006
right.
with my company. Yeah, I was very careful about doing that, you know, being disjoint from the university on that type of thing.
Yeah, fair enough. Do you think because you were doing industry things while you were still faculty, did your work in industry influence your teaching?
Definitely. No question about that. For example, database systems. I learned all about database systems because I used them and joined the IDMS Technical Advisory Committee and worked with the people who were on the forefront of developing the technology. So, yeah, that definitely helped my teaching. I never took a database course, but I learned a lot about it and could then teach graduate-level databases courses at Clemson, so as well as undergraduate courses too in database systems.
Right.
So yeah, it definitely influenced my teaching.
I know that there's another question on here that I haven't asked you. Okay. So we've talked about this a little bit, but the influx of personal computers change what students expected from the program?
Yes.
Yeah.
First of all, in the beginning, when microcomputers first came out, microprocessors,
mm-hmm.
I took a course. Matter of fact, it was a course taught by Motorola, and took a course in microprocessors and how to build the circuitry to surround them to actually put them together into computers. And people are using these for control applications, not for the things we do today. And when I say control, I mean might put it in a toaster and it would figure out when it gets hot enough to pop the toast up. That's not the way they do it. But that was an example of control versus what we think of today, where you do Excel and mm-hmm. Word and all those kind of things. And so from that point, they started developing microcomputers. And the first microcomputers that were really out there were word processors.
Mm-hmm.
IBM had some. In fact, when I was department chair in 85, we bought several microcomputers for the secretaries in the department to use, which, word processors. I also bought microcomputers for the faculty. And we gave them a choice. You could buy a terminal, which is tied into the mainframe, or perhaps a mini computer, because mini computers happened sometime before micros did. You could tie into a mini computer, or you could with a terminal, or you could get a microcomputer, which was self-contained. And you didn't have to tie it in with anything. Well, you could tie it in if you wanted to, but it wasn't necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And so some chose one, some chose the other. But microcomputers continued to progress and get better and better and cheaper to the point where now everybody has one, right? I think it's a requirement now at Clemson. You got to have one when you come to school.
Basically, yeah.
And that did a whole lot of good for not only computer science, did a good for every discipline, I think, at Clemson. If you think of what goes on in English, when I was a student, I used a typewriter for my dissertation and my master's thesis.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you left out a word or misspelled something, you went back, oh, I got to put another word in there. That means this is going to overflow to the next page. So I'm going to retype the next page and the one after that. And so you did a lot of work. I did a lot of work, as did others, I'm sure. Saying, okay, I got to put a word in there. I want to put a word in there so it won't overflow. So I'm going to change this sentence over here to make it a little different so the things will fit. And I'll use one less word here because I have to use an extra word here. And there's a lot of wordsmithing
mm-hmm.
and a lot of manipulation. So I couldn't really say the things the way I wanted to because it would take too much typing. But today, you type it, you turn it in as a draft. Your English professor says, nope, you should have done this, that, and the other, whatever. You take it back, you make a change, it takes you, 30 seconds? And as opposed to, several hours, which it used to take me to be able to do that kind of thing. So that, you raise the writing to a different level.
Mm-hmm.
You can do something real quick, look it over, change it, yourself without even going to your professor and get it the way you want it without having to go over and over and over and over.
Right.
So it's a huge advantage to those kind of courses and any other kind of course you want. You're not take your notes. The professor can send you an email, with an assignment or whatever it is. Just so much more efficient for everybody involved in every curriculum.
For sure. I can't imagine writing my thesis on a typewriter.
Oh, believe me, it was hard. My first one I did myself. My second one for my doctorate degree, I actually hired someone to do that.
Oh, okay.
Cost a lot of money too because they had to do everything I was doing.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
But anyway, that's the way it was.
Yeah, I remember in my master's thesis, I ended up reorganizing a lot of things. So I was copying and pasting paragraphs on paragraphs and putting them 3 pages behind and 3 pages in front. And can't imagine doing that work without a screen.
You spent a lot of time reading your first draft, which was handwritten, and you couldn't hardly read it by the time you mark it all up the way you wanted it to be before you went to the typewriter.
So I think I've asked you everything that I wanted to, but I do want to ask, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you just want to make sure?
No, I was just going to say, I have not been real close to the computer science faculty in the past several years. In fact, I probably know one or two people on the faculty today who were on the faculty back then. I think Mark Smotherman, who is the person that referred us to one another.
Yes.
He might be the only person that's left there there's three more too. The two I hired, they're still there, and Mark, of course. But the rest of them, I really haven't kept very, very close to. But one of the things that I tried to convince the administration on unsuccessfully was that I really think computer engineering and computer science ought to be in the same department.
Yeah.
I really do because, what I'm doing today is a perfect illustration of that. We're developing hardware and firmware, which goes in the hardware,
mm-hmm.
and software that all have to work together. And so you have to know something about all three subjects in order to really get a really good solution. But today, computer science is primarily, with very little exception, software.
Mm-hmm.
Computer engineering is mostly hardware with a little software. They probably have more software and computer engineering than they have hardware and computer science. But really, to do the justice to the students, I really think that those two departments ought to be together. The curriculum ought to be such that you're going to be taking some of one and some of the other, and the courses can be designed so that one supports the other. There are a lot of things that could happen if they were in the same department. But there were, when I was there, particularly in the early days, a lot of turf protection. No, I don't want to do that because, you know, you're going to take over what I'm doing, you know, and then whatever. Mm-hmm. But and that's silly because that's not what's best for the students. And it hasn't happened yet. And so to the extent that people would ever listen to me, I would suggest that it does happen.
Well, I mean, I don't know why they wouldn't. You were the first computer science faculty we had, so.
I was the first computer science faculty member, so hopefully not the last. No, I'm kidding, of course. They're doing some great things over there in computer science. I was probably more applied than most of my colleagues. And that's not bad. That's good. I mean, you need some of both.
Yeah.
But that was just my bent. I enjoyed getting my fingers dirty, my hands dirty. And that's one of the reasons I started the company that I did after that. And so.
Yeah. And it sounds like you're doing really exciting work now.
We are. We're doing a lot of fun things. In fact, we have a rising senior in computer science and an internship working for us this summer. Doing a great job. He's also a cheerleader. I haven't seen him on the court or the field, you know, cheering because I didn't know him until recently. But he's a great guy, doing a great job. So he's getting a good education in computer science, that's for sure. We're actually teaching a lot of computer engineering this summer. He's doing a lot of stuff with, you know, beer board, you know, work. So he's said, wow, this is neat stuff. So he's learning some things, and he's bright, so he has no problem. I think more students need to be able to do that, have exposure to both.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and turn off
sure.
our recording.
Sure, no, that's right. Fine.